Teradata has been a longtime member of TSIA. And if you are a software company that has been around a long time, you probably are supporting customers in all types of postures: on-prem, single-tenant hosted, multi-tenant SaaS. Also, there's probably lots of legacy customization out there in the install base. This is not a job for the faint of heart. I am Thomas Law, the executive director of TSIA. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today I'm going to be joined by Alex Consul, SVP of Global Support Services at Teradata. And we're going to be discussing the strategies and tactics of successfully supporting such a diverse install base. So let's get the insight engine running here. Alex, thanks so much for joining us here. It's great to see you again. And let's just start out. Can you explain the full scope of your responsibilities at Teradata so people understand that?
Yeah, sure. First of all, thank you, Thomas. And thank you for having me here today. I've been looking forward to this for a while. At Teradata, I lead the global support services, as you mentioned. I report into the COO, and he's previously chief customer officer, but we expanded that role to encompass all those things, plus a few others. And that effectively is managed services, professional services, global support services, cloud operations, plus the company strategy, IT, InfoSec, and corporate marketing, which ended up becoming more of a COO role for the company, and effectively leading a large percentage of the company. And I am responsible for all things support, all things incoming. A little bit about Teradata before I just did. And we're an analytical platform serving some of the top customers across key industries. For example, in telecom, we're in 19 of the top 20. In retail, 8 of the top 10. Travel and transportation, 16 of the top 20. And I can go on with life sciences, financial services, and media entertainment, as well as healthcare and manufacturing. But I'll spare some of the stats there on that. As a global support leader, as I said, I handle all incoming things from cloud to on-prem and everything in between. And everything in between is a thing, believe it or not. When I say in between, I mean things like hybrid, where you've got things on-prem and cloud. In the last few months, I've been dealing with several challenges, particularly in Australia, related to hybrid deployment models and interesting things customers are trying to do to deal with regulatory compliance, cost optimization, and things like that. And in between can also be things like DIY, where they just want our application and want to land it in their own, basically, data center tech stack in the cloud that they've organized for their data warehousing needs or their analytic platform capabilities that they're trying to design on their own from a system perspective. So that's, in a sense, kind of the scope of the role that I have today.
One of the main reasons I wanted to have you on, because again, it is that complexity. If you've been around for a long time, like Teradata has, you are going to have customers that are in all kind of posture. That is just the state of legacy software company. And so let's start with just organizational structure. So how have you structured your support organization to deal with the fact that you do have customers in all these different postures?
Yeah. So a couple of things. Going back to the broader scope, myself and my peer in cloud operations are right and lefts, right? That's an important synergistic alignment, and you can't operate in silos, particularly when you're talking about cloud and cloud success, and for that matter, hybrid success. The other is the relationship or product. So I would be remiss in not saying that there's a component across the company that really needs to be there. And the idea of silo mentality is long gone, right? I mean, any organization that's operating that way is probably not only set
off. I don't know if the mentality is long gone. It's good to say that that's not the way you're operating. I don't know if it's long gone in the industry, but I'll agree with what you say.
I guess with a lot of my peer set, you know, with the cloud support providers and the support leaders that I interact with there or in other areas, I kind of see the breaking down of those walls and the success really tied to that tight integration, I think is part of the thing I'm going to try to point out there. But in mine, simply stated and briefly, there's five major functions within the scope of the function I have. The first handles all incoming support, which is reactive and proactive, and I'll get into that later on. But this includes our base team, which is effectively our foundation, our tech support specialists. And they're not contact centers or call centers, and you know, they're not like lightweight and kind of just pass it through and stuff like that. Our tech support specialists are, you know, are pretty heavy duty, and they cycle through 30 to 45 minutes of the incoming to try to solve it at the first touch and avoid going to other levels of the organization. The remaining part of that first function is level two, level three. This is start getting the generalists, more SME technical support specialists, and we organize into the technical components of the stack. The second function is our critical customer support. These I call the Green Berets of the group. When the moment of truth strikes, and the moment of truth is important for our customers, because this is where we make or break our brand equity here when it comes to the support experience, they show up and they're technical incident managers by title, but they have, based on failure modes, SMEs that show up at timestamp zero. And we have playbooks for return to service to ensure that we're not losing minutes in terms of getting systems back up. I mean, I'll talk a little bit more about availability later on as we get into it and as the opportunity arises. That's the second function. And it's a lean and mean team, you know, follow the sun. They deal with mainly SEV1 swarms is what we call it. We've moved away from kind of elevating and bringing people on. We bring them all in. And this includes our cloud service providers, by the way, or third-party vendors for on-prem that participate. For the sustaining engineering team, which is the third component, this is basically a dedicated software developers that's in the Global Support Services that works very closely with product for a more rapid response to customer found defects so that we're moving in days and weeks and not months and roadmaps and, you know, we'll fit it in when we can type of thing. They run the e-fix process, which is our emergency fix process, but they also integrate into routine maintenance release process that we have with product and all the testing that goes in there so that it's not independent or anything like that. The fourth dimension is the global change control team, made up of system change automation and delivery arms within the regions to deploy software changes, patches, minor updates, major upgrades, installs, deinstalls, things like that for on-prem. They span the entire gamut. And the fifth and final component of the group as far as a function is the product support planning function, handles cradle-to-grave support planning for our products, including third-party support and maintenance. That's kind of effectively the main core components of the group. I can get into more detail, but that's probably good enough.
So, I mean, there's a lot of, in a sense, complexity there because you do have a lot of moving parts with all the different environments that you're supporting. So it is a very mature and complex organization. And I'm curious, you know, when I talk to support leaders right now, and I don't care, you know, how big or small you are as a software provider, everybody is under pressure to prove the value of the support model to their customers, right? The customers aren't just going to say, yeah, let me renew that premium support contract with you just because I love you. Like that's like those days are gone, right? And so yeah. How do you, Teradata, articulate that value to the customer in terms of how you're supporting them through the customer lifecycle? Help me understand how you articulate that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I love it, in fact, because, and it's one that I don't take for granted and one that I think you need to live every day and every quarter and every year, right? If you're kind of like basing that on some sort of set thing, I think you constantly need to revalue your organization and how you're doing it. For us at Teradata, support isn't only about a backend safety net or function that some of those functions might suggest. It's an integral part of the customer value journey, if I could say it that way. And what we focus on is ensuring availability, performance and continuous improvement to customers so that they realize the full business outcomes from their investment on our platform. And really, at the end of the day, for our customers, nothing matters. Availability is the feature. Without availability, and really the scalable performance that comes with availability, are table stakes for us, right? Nor the discussion is relevant. If you don't have availability and the scalable, predictable performance our customers depend on and is at the heart of the nervous system for whether they want to look at somewhere else or stay with Teradata, that becomes the bread and butter. And I think, yeah, sure, all the other stuff that comes along with it, the interesting analytic use cases that we're working with our customers on is all important. But, you know, mission critical and running those AI use cases in production that kind of drives and generates revenue or fuels growth for their business and the industry that they're in won't happen without it. So for us, what our CEO and the ELT, when they go visit customers, the thing that kind of gets reinforced is the supportability stands out as a contributor to the brand equity and the brand loyalty that our customers have. It's a dependable point compared to our competitors or alternatives that may be the new bright shiny objects on the block, right? And to say just a bit more on that, our redefining comes in investments to protect that availability, right? Continuously identifying and optimizing performance for our end user SLAs is another area that we contribute through the customer value journey. And that becomes an important proof point for us when it comes time to renewal, right? And it makes the conversation really easy from a TCO perspective. They see the availability. They see the actions that we've provided and recommended to optimize performance. We catalog those. We bring them. Here's the total IO that we've saved. Here's what you've been able to get in terms of growth out of your system from capacity and consumption perspective. And when it comes to renewal, it's not like you're trying to say, well, why would I want to renew this? It's like a no-brainer for them because they know that they've got the stability. In fact, renewals is not a problem for us. What becomes a problem is they want to stay on the tech stack too long. And I have to start reviewing exceptions for the tech stack because it's approaching its end of support life. And you really want them to have continuity and you're assessing risk at that point if they continue to stay on, because we've either off that code base or the platform is long in the tooth, if I could say it that way. So the renewals don't tend to be a problem for us, but the investments are all on availability and optimization.
Okay, so there's two things you put on the table I want to click into. So one of them in terms of that, because you mentioned the term continuous improvement, and also what I heard there in those renewal conversations is, hey, obviously you've had to make sure the platform's up and available, they're happy with that, but there has to be a story there around how we've continued to improve your environment. And one thing you mentioned was could be saving IO, could be other things. Talk a little bit more about how you articulate continued improvement. Is it cost savings? Is it performance? Is it, what are the things you click into with them to demonstrate, hey, we're making your environment better and better and better?
Yeah, the part that we've been attempting for years now with a lot of TSIA's guidance in terms of costing value has been the biggest struggle and continues to be the struggle. So what we end up doing in terms of valuing and dollarizing the value is really around the TCO and what they're getting in terms of additional workload, additional queries, additional applications, additional use cases, and we inventory all that. But at the heart of all this is our telemetry and observability, right? More than 70% of our incoming is all auto-generated, that customers don't ever need to go on a portal, open a ticket, make a phone call. It comes in naturally. And so through that lens, we get the protection of availability, and we get the capacity consumption view of things that allows us to either auto-recommend and help our customers, or through human interfaces, have engagements around your consuming, your workloads, kind of let's talk about it. It tends to open up a managed services engagement if they don't already have one, or a consulting engagement if they don't already have it. A lot of times that sneaks through the support chain. And so we'll start that process to kind of get their appetite wet in terms of what we see and what we can do. And then we kind of say, all right, you really could take this on further with managed services and workload management and activities like that. So hopefully I got to kind of what you were looking for there. But telemetry and observability is at the heart of being able to really derive that value from a systems perspective, resource utilization and kind of all those things. And then we try to dollarize from a system value perspective what benefit they've achieved from the system.
Yeah, no, and that I was like, again, in a sense, the holy grail, being able to connect those dots, and it can be challenging. But again, what I heard there on the total cost of ownership and what you're getting out of my platform, being able to continue to articulate you're getting, you know, more for the same or more for less, whatever, that's a good conversation to have in terms of the value. Are you ready for what's next in tech services? At TSI World Envision, we're bringing together innovative leaders from across the industry to tackle the biggest questions facing tech companies today. How do we harness AI? Not just a buzzword, but as a revenue engine. How do we reimagine the customer experience to drive growth in a digital-first world? And most importantly, are we ready to lead that change? Envision is where strategy meets execution, where data meets decision-making, and where the conversations that shape the future of our industry are happening in real time. Join us October 20th through the 22nd at the lovely Aria Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. You'll gain access to research-backed insights, proven frameworks, and real-world success stories to help your organization not just keep up, but lead. Register now at tsia.com/conference and walk away with clarity, tools, and the inspiration to turn today's uncertainty into tomorrow's opportunity. The other thing, though, you put on the table here is when you have customers that are on aging platforms that you really want to get them off, but they don't want to get off. And again, that is a common challenge with folks that have been around as long as you have, right? And so you're in this renewal conversation and you're just dying to get them into something new. So tell me a little bit about how you navigate these conversations. Any tactics that seem to, to work better?
Yeah, I love that space. It's a fun space for me with my job. You know, as a leader, if you think about charter and scope of the organization, it actually, if you think about these things, it becomes things that become rewarding and make the job more interesting. I get to engage with go-to-market. I get to engage with renewal account managers, right? But we have a process. It's a control process that you have to go through an exception. The exception process is really to identify risk for the customer. It does two things. It evaluates risk and makes a recommendation for whether we should or shouldn't. Yeah. And if we do, what is going to be required from the customer's environment in order for us?
Provide the exception. So you're going to grant the exception. Is that what you're deciding?
Correct. And therefore grant the renewal or not. And really, we want to be able to always do it. But if we don't, it's really because we're protecting risk on behalf of the customer, right? Other components of the software or hardware stack are going to create implications for them where it's going to be best effort. So if it is that, we document the fact that we're going to be best efforts. But more importantly for that, with the account teams, we make sure that there's a business continuity strategy with the customer. So if they're extending, I mean, what are we going to do? Extend this to perpetuity? We can't. I mean, what are the conversations? And then you start getting into things like customer success. You start getting into pipeline and customer journey management from an account management perspective. And it becomes really exciting because like this customer, shouldn't we really be positioning it for this cloud solution? Or this customer, shouldn't we be positioning it for this on-prem platform solution? Or is this maybe a case for a hybrid, right? So it starts creating kind of the maturing and fueling of customer journeys and making sure that there's a connection between this end of support life and where we're heading with the customer and managing customer for life and customer loyalty and business continuity with that customer. So it's an exciting space. We have kind of a prescriptive process that we follow to evaluate the risk. We make sure that the risk is really translated in terms that the customer can digest and knows that we have their best interest in mind. And that if they move forward, that they need to be aware of the downsides of things that are dated, software or hardware.
So, I mean, I think what's interesting about that topic, and I'm glad that we kind of clicked into that, is I'll just make a couple general observations, again, for any company that has a lot of legacy stuff out there. The path of least resistance in a renewal, and often what an account team is just going to basically advocate for, is, hey, let's just get the renewal, man. Let's just take the money off the table, and they're happy. And what's the problem here? Why would we introduce any risk into this sales conversation, right? Now, and I can't blame sales for wanting to go there, right? The path of least resistance. That's going to be the natural place to go to. But what you articulate, which I think is important, is the fact that in reality, that's introducing a lot of risk for the customer, number one, and it's not in the customer's best interest to just do that. And everybody's got to get their head around that. And then two, what you mentioned is a winning tactic there is have clear criteria that everybody can understand. The account team, the sales can understand, you can understand on the support team, the customer can understand and say, hey, we're not just trying to be difficult here and not renew you. We're looking at this objectively. Here are the challenges and the risks introduced. This is how you score, whatever. And this is why we are really advocating for a different customer journey. And everything there is easier said than done. Because again, when the check is looking at you in the face and the customer's like, can we just end this and just let me write you a check for what I already have? And I'm sure those conversations are always difficult and never easy. But I think having clear criteria and really educating the sales team on why this is actually in the best interest of the customer are super important tactics there for sure. So let me shift gears on you. I want to talk about AI. Can't have one of these episodes without talking about it, specifically in support. And I want to talk about how you folks are approaching it, how you're using it. I have to make this observation. In the news recently, there's been a lot of headlines around how support folks are being impacted by AI. Salesforce made a very large announcement around this, 4,000 some people being impacted. And there's this general talk track of AI is all about just grinding out my service, labor. That's what I'm going to do with AI, right? That's sort of this mantra. TSIA, we just don't believe that's the end game. We don't see AI magically implementing itself, being supported, customers being successful without services. We think that there is a lot of work to be done by services, probably being done obviously a lot very differently, but we're in this sort of teenage awkward years, if you will, in terms of AI's here. what are you doing to just, you know, reduce your costs? And that's just a blunt story, and it's not the complete story. So with that backdrop, I'm just very curious how you guys are thinking about it and what you are doing with it already.
Yeah, I resonate with some of those themes. And first of all, you know, our leadership team, I'm thankful for them, and I've been in the role that I have, quite frankly, because of them. And they understand how the customer support and services space really fits into the complete life cycle and looking at customers from a 360 perspective and all that good stuff. So it makes the sales job a bit easier. But for us, I think it's going to be table stakes and a game changer as it relates to continuing the differentiation through the customer support experience, right? If you don't, I think all the things that we've done in our past and what we're known to be for our customers as it relates to that portability experience and that dependability that they have on support and the availability of our systems is going to be all for naught if we don't kind of really take AI seriously and how we can kind of really take it to the next level. And we don't want to play follow the leader. We want to be the leader and be part of the momentum that I think customers can gain a greater benefit from as we integrate AI into the support model. And, you know, we would be remiss to say that there should be productivity gains. It should streamline and lean out things that you've used humans for that we really should be using machines to drive out repetitive tasks. And the automation space that we've been in the last 5 to 10 years has addressed that concern in that topic to a certain extent. And AI is just that on steroids, maybe, right? In terms of the impressions that that's creating kind of out there in, you know, professional and open society in general, right? For us, I think philosophically, we look at AI as a must have in terms of taking that experience to the next level, the brand loyalty, the equity, and the outcomes that that could serve for our customers. And that means like faster time to resolution, you know, the ability to self-solve for those that want to, and having the ability to offer on a silver platter what the self-solve might look like because of how we tie our knowledge and what we're able to see and provide real-time, instantaneous, and instant gratification is an important part there because it's a real-time factor. Is important. You lose that moment, you're going to...
I assume you're meaning the customers basically because you can give them some AI capabilities, or whatever, where they can basically just interact and solve the problem themselves. Is that the scenario?
That's the notion.
Yeah. And so I'm curious in terms of, as you look at the customer base, because, you know, I'll give you the analogy in our world, we have AI inquiry is something that, you know, we stood up a couple months ago, and it's really interesting watching how professionals behave. Right. So some professionals are like, oh my God, I can self-serve. I can, this is like kids in the candy shop. Right. I mean, they're just like super happy to use the technology. They want to do that. And others are still like, yeah, no, I still want to talk to somebody, whatever. And so I'm just curious, and of course, you have a very technical customer base there. What are you seeing in terms of the adoption of these new AI capabilities? Is it very viral? Is it sort of, you know, slow and steady? Just what's your experience there as you put these tools on the table?
Yeah, I think it's super important that you think about your target audience when you're talking about this, right? I think often I get approached with the idea that this is like some sort of simple web service or application and that's not what this is. So we're not talking about that consumer or that consumption population. Yeah. We're really talking about what you suggested, which is a much more tech savvy audience that we're dealing with, right? Our customer base in terms of building that right search engine, kind of help me solve my problem fast. They're an extension of our product support engineering team.
Sure.
I mean, they're that capable where they're sometimes smarter or help us solve the problem, right? So thinking about them in that regard and really making the tools that we have to solve our problems with thresholds, guardrails, and criteria available to them where it is appropriate. It's more around their data. So there's privacy and security that we feel more comfortable that we need permission anyway from a do no harm perspective, or it's straightforward enough for them to go solve. We want to unlock those and make that more available. So that's how we think about it. And it needs to be a bit more graceful. I think the early stages of this with chatbots become more RPA related than they do a virtual agent related, if I can say it that way. So less interactive, less, you know, kind of contextual, less understanding what the customer is trying to deal with, and more like a calculator, right? And less of that grace, if you will, that interaction. So I think we're like probably a year out from making what we have going on to be more transparent and available for a subset of our tech savvy customers that can solve it on their own, right? We will, in advance of that, push closing a case, publishing case, really making available to them, here's how you could solve this. We would be happy to go resolve this for you. If it's a maintenance window, select any of these three maintenance windows, or if it's something that really we need to get in and tune some parameters or configuration settings and things like that for optimization, that we would tell them what we're doing and why we're doing it and get their permission to do that. Or they here are the instruction set where you can do that. And that becomes a kind of a transition change management approach to eventually them being able to kind of, I've got this issue, what do I do? And it automatically pops kind of the guided troubleshooting, the KB that we would provide them, or the script that they can self-run.
And so I'm curious, when you look at this evolving AI landscape, what use cases are you most bullish on, you think, that are going to be super helpful for your support organization?
Yeah, so a couple of things. We've embedded AI to accelerate time to resolve, as I said, with smarter case routing. So that's one. Signature matching is the one that I just ran through there. Contextual recommendations and surfacing knowledge faster rather than in a machine sense. Our first attempts at this was more of a homegrown application we called SAM, Service Analytics Machine. She was part of our base team. We referred to her as a she, and you know, kind of created that culture and that embodiment of, again, 5 years of kind of us thinking about this in terms of having an auto-generated resolution recommendation that, for the most part, only pivoted to our product support engineers.
Yeah.
With that homegrown, we never really got to a level of accuracy with precision or recall, which are more AI terms, to be able to do a customer resolution recommendation and avoid the human touch. But we're in the early stages of a controlled release here that we've been working on with an outside company to really integrate that intelligent front door for that signature matching for known signatures with known solutions that have been provided to identify those and be able to redirect those. So issue matching for faster resolution, case routing are some of the primary examples of that. So automated troubleshooting would be the thing that we will apply here in the next two quarters. We already have the automation of the fixes completed, but now mapping the incoming and the automation of that troubleshooting so that it becomes more humanless is the part that we haven't quite achieved there yet. And then you start getting into predictive space that we're at the early stages where alerts really become predictive and preventative. And then workload analytics is the other one that drives kind of recommendations to optimize their system performance and ties that renewal question that we had earlier.
Yeah. So if you think about all the cases you have right now that come in and absolutely require human intervention at some level, right? Could be light touch, could be heavy touch. What percentage of those cases do you think you are going to have technology will be able to resolve and just take them off the table? And let's just pick a horizon of, like, you know, 3 years down the road. Is that 10%? Is that 20%? I mean, just, you know.
I would say that number for us is probably in the 20 to 30% range. And I wouldn't say in the 3 year horizon. I would say in the 18 to 24 month horizon. And I think that's worst case. I think to get a little bit more data behind that data, I would say that, you know, depending on where we're at with technology life cycles and transition of our architecture in the install base, mm-hmm. right? From a net new set of issues versus known issues and understanding how the tech stacks that are in the install base are operating and performing and behaving, I would say that we're probably dealing anywhere between 50 and 60% of the incoming. 50% is probably a known issue that we've seen, right? And we're not necessarily find ones, fix many type of, model. You know, fix on fail, it becomes more of that. And that's the opportunity that I think you can really remove from touching it all.
Yeah.
And I think 20 to 30% is accessible. Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's a great conversation because if you think about, you know, let's take the two ends of the spectrum. So one end of the spectrum is that AI can just come in and just do everything. You don't even need support people, right? And the other end is, only 5% of, this is the MIT study, only 5% of AI use cases are successful and it's really a bunch of hype. And the reality is, I mean, let's just take this 30% number in 24 months, which I think is very realistic in line with everything else we're seeing in the industry. I mean, that is significant. That is a big chunk of stuff that, like you say, we've already seen it before. It's like, it's really not a huge value add for us to get somebody involved. So I think, you know, for people to just understand, these are big moves on the chessboard in terms of helping. And then my follow-up question is, as you unlock that 30%, where now your support folks don't have to deal with that, where do you want to focus their attention? What do you envision is the thing that I can get them to be now do that they don't have to do this stuff that the AI can take care of it? We've seen it 100 times before. What does that unlock for you as a leader in terms of that talent?
Yeah, I think what that helps, I mean, if you think about our maturity curves of tech stacks that get rolled out and deployed in our install base and what the changes cause from a workload dynamics perspective, how that impacts performance and SLAs for our end customers, what that 30% unlocks is really the acceleration of new technology adoption. And the acceleration of understanding the nuances and the nature of new tech stacks and how they affect workloads for end customers. Yeah. And so that becomes a faster realization of high availability. And when I say high availability, we're talking about, you know, over 4.9s, 5.9s, above our 3.9s SLAs, right? So, and then performance optimization where they can kind of get more with the system resources faster with new tech stacks as CPU increases, memory increases, right? IO increases, all those performance factors increase. So I think that 30% helps a faster realization of value. Mm-hmm. Again, my view of this is it's not about resource elimination, right? It's about resource repurposing for faster time to value and continue to bolster up the support experience, the Teradata platform experience, where they don't have a reason to look anywhere else. And it becomes, again, table stakes for raising the bar of expectations in terms of the value that they'll get. So that's what I would say is just the time to value and accelerating that realization of value.
Yeah. No, I want to get your perspective on that, because, again, I think that that conversation right there for support executives, right? What type of benefits am I getting from AI realistically? And then my vision of what I'm going to unlock cycles, what do I do with them? I mean, I think every support executive's got to be thinking about that right now. Every Tectonic listener is well aware, I am a big believer that AI is a game changer for how professionals in the technology industry will do their jobs. TSI Research is not immune to that reality. I am proud to say that we have been aggressively experimenting on how AI can change the way we create research and deliver those research insights to our members. And now we are ready to release TSIA Intelligence, the first Gen AI model designed exclusively for technology services. Unlike generic Gen AI tools, TSIA Intelligence taps into our real-world, industry-validated data that is not in the public domain. We have designed this model to give you clear, actionable, and board-ready insights. Right now, in technology services, the stakes are really high. Every decision counts. Good decisions can build your career. Bad ones can end it. General LLMs are incredibly powerful, but you need specialized insights built on industry data that you can trust. That is TSI Intelligence. To check it out, visit tsi.com/intelligence.
Another thing I definitely wanted to ask you, because I think, you know, what everybody in your chair is dealing with is sort of making intelligent decisions around your own tech stack. Because these tools, I mean, you guys are inventing your own tools, but then there's tools that are off the shelf that are coming in. How do you decide what type of new technology, AI technology capabilities to deploy, to explore, to pilot, Teradata? How do you go through, you know, that whole
thing? Yeah, I think our approach is probably three-pronged in terms of how we evaluate those investments. First, we invest where technology demonstrably improves speed, quality, or customer experience. At the end of the day, we kind of try to quantify in those areas. We're building flexibility in our system map, you know, kind of our support model solution stack with API-driven integration with our CRM, case management, telemetry, our AI ML engines, right? Just make sure that that's a more cohesive system. Is flexibility is super important in the way that we're thinking about it, so that API becomes a central point of the way that we think about it with our operational and teams that kind of engage my group with kind of how are we progressing and where we're investing. And then at the end of the day, the decisions are guided by operational efficiency and customer value delivery, right? At the end of the day, we kind of try to think about them in those dimensions. And all the things that we talked about earlier in the conversation, how are they fueling that in respect to continue to promote the renewal rates that we have, continue to reduce the churn? How is that going to accelerate our optimization of their systems, right? All that stuff from a customer value delivery perspective gets evaluated against the operational efficiencies. So that's kind of how we think about it. And I'll tell you that if I look at our top 10 initiatives, 7 of the top 10 initiatives are all related to AI and automation integration into our support model.
So there's the criteria in terms of, you know, do I invest in this area or not? You balance it against the benefits they're going to create for the customer, et cetera. And then in terms of the actual sort of vendors you select, et cetera, how do you guys think about that? Because there's this whole new wave of folks out there who have new tools to help, et cetera, that are, you know, knocking on everybody's door. And some of them are super startups. Also the legacy companies, I'm sure you have vendors that are already in there saying, I've got new capabilities. How do you guys sort through that or sort of building your own? Like, hey, let's take some tools and build on top of it. How do you think about that?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I kind of covered at the start of this. Our first attempt was really homegrown. We had data scientists, data engineers, software developers, a team of 20 for SAM over 5 years ago, where, you know, it's still living today and we're using it today in terms of recommendations, but the pivot's only to the product support engineers, not to the customers. And so what we're finding is CRM, you don't play around with, right? You're going to need to make a really good decision around that, right? Yeah. But when it comes to search, you know, we've been with Coveo, we've moved around, and more the CRM systems are becoming more sophisticated with their search. I think the best answer for the audience, I think for us, is in the AI space, we're tending to operate with smaller players because they're more nimble and they're more agile. And I think the entire industry should be in a state of experimenting, failing fast, integrating. And as long as it's API driven and you know that, you know, if this isn't going to work out, we'll work with another large language model that is more purpose built for maybe what we're trying to do, right? And we go through kind of the proof of concept, the user acceptance testing. We've gone through that road before we deploy this controlled release. And even the controlled release, if you can hear that language, it's going to go through kind of all the checks and balances to make sure that the tool is going to be worth its weight in gold. I think going with a heavier solution with what Salesforce and Einstein might have or ServiceNow might have, there's big dollars associated with that. So our preference is to work with smaller players and experiment, learn, fail, learn, fail, learn, fail, and then kind of decide in the grand scheme of things where we want to put all our chips if we need to think about it that way.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you sharing that because, again, I think this is something that every tech executive is grappling with in terms of, you know, how do I navigate that? So I think what you articulated there was a solid strategy. And I'm watching the clock here. There's one more question I definitely want to get on the table because there's one thing that we talked about last time we were chatting. And this was this concept you were talking about. You have initiatives that are related to deploying a structured problem solving methodology, that this is something core to how you operate. And so just share a little bit about what that is all about.
Yeah, that's great. So I've been in this role now for close to a decade. I came from product development and kind of that's where my bringing, but I was really happy to kind of lead customer support because in the product support world, I really led my development teams through satellite customer engagements and understanding a day in the life of the product and had a really strong tie with customers, which is kind of why I got tapped to kind of go do this. And my affinity for product and building that strong relationship is super important in a role like this. But the idea behind this is when I first hit the scene, when you get into at the time we were running homegrown and we were in the process of making a major decision on our CRM platform, a lot of the engagement for incoming things when we're resolving them is a whiteboard with chronological events. And, you know, it's like a Mensa exam to kind of figure out, all right, what's the problem? What have we done to address it? And it's a very inconsistent and non-methodical way of addressing them. So what we did is we took some of the best problem solvers, got them in a room, and we said, hey, what's the life cycle of solving an incoming thing? Whether it is an incident, a problem, what's the life cycle that you go through? And what we've done is created a structured problem-solving methodology and problem not necessarily in strict idle standards, but problem in terms of any incoming thing. Some of the tenets around this is create knowledge that we publish. We don't close cases, we publish cases. So curating knowledge and knowledge as a centerpiece, and as you think about AI and how important knowledge is, that's one of the points of interest here. We want to standardize and create a greater craft around solving things than just immediately jumping to a solution because they've seen it before and they've got institutional knowledge. And more importantly, to bottle that up for the other 300 or 400 or 500 or 1,000 people, depending on the size of your organization. The idea would be to have you identified the problem. What is it? What are the issues or the symptoms? You know, when we have AI, if we've iterated through that because we've seen a known issue, it would pre-populate, hey, this has been seen before. Here's the way the problem's been described. Here are the symptoms and issues. Here's what you might want to validate that you're seeing in terms of symptoms and issues from underlying system resources. we will probably have knowledge if it's been seen before, because if you go through that loop, here's the knowledge that pertains to what we last solved and the troubleshooting steps that had been taken. They validate the fact that that is the case. They enter a reproduction loop if it warrants. We have a workaround stage or a mitigation stage, and then we have a root cause and a fix stage. And then we go into validating the root cause and fix with internal testing from the repro that we did, external customer validation. And then we go through a closed loop corrective action. How do you avoid giving birth to this issue, so to speak? Five whys type of thinking. Again, building a craft for the product support engineers in a more consistent, standardized fashion. And at the end, you don't close a case. We will avoid closing cases. We will publish a case. It'd take the, rather than going out of band now and creating a KCS article, if you're in part of that cult and coaches and publishers and things like that, or whether you're still in the yesteryears where you're kind of taking time to now go back in the last 3 weeks and document the things in a KB, we don't do that. You just solve the problem. And by engaging in the structure problem solving methodology, we're going to create an abstract and publish the KB, and it'll go to a layman person or a person that doesn't have technical SME domain over it. And if you were given this, could you perform these tasks? And certainly we'll have a toggle for things that are more customer self-repairable and will require a more attention to that voice or that input. A code review, think about it as that way, right? Coming from the product development. So you have the person that's never seen the code before and never seen the knowledge article before to perform the troubleshooting step, and then an SME to say, hey, there's no way that this should have solved that problem, or yeah, this seems reasonable. Let's go ahead and iterate through this. And as you get precision and recall from AI terms and a level of accuracy thresholds by the iteration loop that you see on that known issue, you move from humans touching it to quickly deploying it as a recommendation, whether it's in a change control that we automate for a software fix, or whether it's a set of changes that need to be made to the system that we either would do or the customer should do. And that's kind of the general premise of it. And structural problem solving is one of the initiatives, but we've got the intelligent front door, that AI that's going to be an engine that fuels kind of the known, seen once, fixed many kind of concept. And through the iteration, we'll validate, verify, get to a level of accuracy. And then rather than flipping to that product support engineer, you flip to the customer and provide a recommended resolution. So I'll stop there and see if that hit the mark for you.
Yeah, I just wanted you to share again how you guys are thinking about that and approaching that. And in what I liked about that description you're putting on the table there, I mean, support has always been. This is a discipline that has a lot of complexity and has always required a lot of structure. The more structure, the better. And the more, like you're saying, you know, really disciplined problem solving and how you get really good at problem solving and compressing the time it takes to solve problems and getting those answers out. That's the game. You never stop chipping on that to get better and better and better at playing that game right there. You know, and it's why I think support has always been a really intellectually interesting area, and also not for the faint of heart, as you know. So
yeah, 100%. Yeah. In fact, over to the side here, I have like 10 bulletproof vests. It depends on the customer, the day of the week. And, you know,
Absolutely. Well, Alex, I really appreciate you coming in and sharing your insights. It's been a lot of fun talking to you. I always close with a question of the day from these episodes. And the question I have for the audience today is that the best practices in support services, you know, they've always been evolving, but the bar is absolutely getting higher. You know, customers want value and executives want efficiency, you know, not just going out and hiring new people to solve stuff. So the question really is, your support organization ready to meet these ever higher expectations? Cheers, everybody. One of the main reasons we founded TSIA almost 20 years ago was to establish accurate operational benchmarks for technology service businesses that just didn't exist anywhere. Benchmarking is a killer tool to quickly understand your strengths and weaknesses. Benchmarking sets you on a journey that starts with where you are, points to what is possible, and identifies the business practices that will get you there. That's why I am super excited we decided to offer a free version of TSI's industry-leading benchmarks with Performance Optimizer. Performance Optimizer is an easy-to-use benchmarking tool you can access from the TSI website. You can assess operational strengths and weaknesses in multiple areas like customer success, professional services, support services, etc. And the Optimizer results prescribe specific actions to address specific challenges and opportunities. This is an amazing offer, and I am so proud we are doing this for all of our loyal Tectonic listeners who may not be corporate TSIA members. To check it out, visit tsia.com/free.